Okay, we're up to Parshas Nesa. Our sages teach us that Nesa is the longest Parsha. At the end of the Parsha, we're going to see the 12 tribes that bring their sacrifices. Identical Parsha that's repeated over and over and over again. As you'll see, the Torah keeps repeating, this tribe brought this much, and the next tribe brings the exact same thing. But again, the Torah goes through all the verses explaining what the next tribe brought. We'll do a quick overview of the Parsha, and then we'll try to go over it with more depth. Our Parsha begins with telling us that we have to give account to the sons of Gershon. They too have to be counted, just like the other Levites from age 30 and up, and they're entrusted with their task. Then we have the sons of Merari. And then we move on to Shlishi. We have the commandment of keeping the camp sanctified. Those that are defiled have to leave the camp. We go on, and the Torah tells us the Karban Asham, if a person's stolen something, they bring an Asham, a special Asham, we'll still discuss that, and they have to pay back with adding a fifth. We're up to Revi. The Torah tells us the mitzvah of a sota. If a man suspects his wife of cheating with someone else, so he gives her, assuming there are no witnesses, he gives her a warning. And then if again he sees that she was alone with that person, then he brings her up to the temple, and she's given special waters to drink, as we will discuss. And if she was faithful to him, then she becomes blessed, and her children, her deliveries are all easy. And if she was unfaithful to him, then her stomach explodes, and she dies, and the man she cheated with dies. Right after that, the Torah gives us the mitzvah of Nazir. If a man takes a vow that a man or a woman takes a vow they will be a Nazir, they are prohibited from cutting their hair, they are prohibited from drinking wine, they are prohibited from becoming defiled to anyone dead, entering any area where there is a dead person. And if they do become defiled, they have to shave their hair and start again. How long are they a Nazir for? There's a minimum of 30 days, but they can take on the vow for as long as they want. When they conclude, they bring a sacrifice, and then they've concluded their nizirut. At the conclusion of the nizirut, they shave off their hair. Then we have the parsha of the blessing of the Jewish people. God tells Aaron, so you shall bless the Jewish people, Yivarecha Hashem Yishmecha Yer Hashem Panavidecha Vichunek, etc., like we hear the Kohanim, Rapta Chamishi. When we conclude the building of the Mishkan, so the Mishkan is anointed, and the vessels are anointed, and now the heads of each tribe bring their sacrifices, and the Torah describes the sacrifice of each tribe, which is very lengthy, and just keeps repeating the same story over and over again, 12 times, and that's really what makes our Parsha so long. Now let's review the Parsha with a little bit more depth. Our parsha is Parshas Noso. We learned about the tribe of Kehas that carries the holiest part of the Mishkan. They carry the Holy of Holies. And so now we're moving on to Gershon. They too get counted. They're going to carry the different curtains. Then we go on to the tribe of the family of Merari. Gershon, Kehas, and Merari are the three sons of Levi. They're divided into the three families. And they get the task of carrying the heavy stuff, the beams, the planks of wood. So they're all counted from 30 years until 50 years, they get counted. So the Levites have 5 years to learn. At 25 years, they enter service. At 30, they really start working. That teaches us a rule, that if a person wants to know if he'll be successful in learning Torah, they have to give themselves a chance for 5 years. After 5 years, you could gauge whether you're up to it or not. Less than that, you haven't given it a chance. That's why the Levites have 5 years training. Less than that, you haven't really started. So, yeah. What I'm telling you is a Gemara and Chulin. Okay. The Torah. Yeah. Correct. The Gemara really says it's 5 years on Talmudic level. But Beseder.
Not from the ground up,
no. It's 5 years after you've entered the Hebrew department, at least. Okay, next, we have a commandment to keep the camp holy. So we have three camps, right? We have the camp of the Shekhinah inside the curtain, inside the Mishkan. Then we have the camp of the Levites. And then we have the camp of Israel. So a person that has tzaraas has to be out of all three camps. He's all the way outside what's called chutz lamachaneh. Then we have a person who's a zav. What's a zav? So we know that a person can have can emit his seed, and that happens when a person ejaculates, when a person's male organ is hard, so he can emit his seed. Now there is something that has the same fluidity, it seems just like a man's semen, but it isn't, and that's called ziva, a flow. That flow is some type of illness. It comes out when a person has no control. It comes out when a person is not hard. Some want to say it's gonorrhea. We don't know exactly what it is. What we know is that when a person has it, so then he is defiled, and anything he touches is defiled, and anything he lifts is defiled, and anything he causes to move is defiled, and his spit, his saliva, his bodily fluids are defiled. So that's a zav. Now, a person who is a zav is permitted to be with his wife. A woman, we have a similar thing, a zava, a woman that has a flow. Now, a woman's flow is totally different than a man's flow, right? A man's flow looks just like the white of an egg. It's something very similar to semen, a male flow, only comes out without control. He's got to wait 7 days, and he checks during those 7 days that he's clean. He wears a little cup over his male organ to check if anything came out, because he has no control when it's going to come out. And after 7 days that he's been clean, he can bring a sacrifice and become pure again. So that's a zav. What's a zava? That's a woman that has a flow. What's a flow? So it looks just like your period. We don't know how to discern between the flow of a period and the flow of a zava, but the difference is when it comes, meaning a woman has a cycle. If it's within that cycle, no problem. But then you have days when she doesn't expect it. So then if she has a flow during the days she doesn't expect it, that's called a zavan. Now, it's a little bit more complex than that. You guys want to understand, or should we move on?
Understand.
Want to understand. Okay, so what's a zavan? So it works as follows. The halacha assumes that a woman's going to have her period with a minimum of an 11-day break between periods. Meaning, let's say a woman's period takes an average of 6 days. The Torah gives her 7 days from the minute she has her onset. Let's say on the first of the month she had her onset. So the average woman is going to have 6 days. That's the average woman, but the Torah gives her seven. Meaning, so on the seventh day her onset, her regular period ended. So now, biblically, she can check herself. She takes a white cloth, she checks she's clean. That night she goes to mikvah, she's pure. That's the biblical thing. We'll get to the rabbinic in a second. Now she's pure. From day 8, we have 11 days during which she's not supposed to have any bleeding. So on day 18, from the halacha, from the Torah's perspective, if on day 19 she's already going to have her period, that's not a zava. That's a woman who has a period. She has a 19-day cycle, right? From the first day of her period to the first day of the next period, 19 days. That's okay. 7 days for the period, 11 days clean, and then another period. So halachically, that's a woman that has a normal cycle. If she starts bleeding before day 18, during the 11 days she's supposed to be clean after her first period, so during those 11 days she becomes a zava. If she sees once, she only has to wait 1 day and then go to mikvah. But if she sees more, then she can run into a situation where she becomes a zava gedola, and that's a woman that's a full-fledged zava. And then the Torah says she has to wait 7 clean days, meaning from the time her bleeding ends, she checks herself before sunset to ensure that her bleeding ended and that the next day is going to begin in cleanliness. That's what's called a hefsek tahara, where a woman checks herself before sunset to check that hefsek, her bleeding stopped, tahara, she has now entered a period of purity. And then when sunset comes, she will now that night begin the 7 clean days. So the next morning she counts day 1 and she checks herself morning and night. The following day, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6, day 7. Comes day 7, she checks herself in the morning. She checks herself in the afternoon before sunset. If she's clean, so then that night she can go to mikveh and she's pure and she comes home. Being that we don't know how to discern between the bleeding of nida or zava, the regular period, or the bleeding that's not a regular period, so it was accepted already in before Talmudic times that any time a woman has her period, she waits until her period ends, and then she waits another 7 clean days. So the average couple is prohibited an average of 13 days a month, because from the minute she has her onset, they're biblically prohibited. She ends her onset after 5 to 6 days. Then she can do a hefsek tahara, and the next morning she starts 7 clean days where she checks herself every morning and afternoon. Until the end of those 7 days, she can go to mikvah. So in a nutshell, that's a zava. Yes, we treat every woman that will have any bleeding as a zava today. Yes?
What was the purpose of a zava and a zava?
Well, it seems that the Torah was indicating that these are people that have some kind of illness. And that's why the Torah wanted them separate.
But I mean, like with Salat, for example, don't we attribute that to Lashon Ha? So is there anything that's attributed to this in particular? Why have something else specifically that is supposed to be outside if you can? From Hashem's perspective, what is it trying to teach us?
Let's leave Zav and Zava for a minute. Let's ask a different question. Why is there any other disease in the world? Saying, you're asking me about a disease and the method in which the Torah said these people should be separate. I'll ask you, why are you asking about this? Just because the Torah gave me a system for this?
How many diseases does the Torah mention? Two that people have to go out of.
Okay, so it seems like these diseases have a spiritual dimension. Remember, Zav and Azava are metame heset. That means that if we have a seesaw, and the Zav sits on this side, and the seesaw goes up on that side, anything that's on the other side of the seesaw is tame. Right. So the Torah is revealing to us some kind of defilement that we wouldn't have fathomed. You know, you're sitting in, he sits in the car, everyone in the car became tame because he shifted the whole car. That's not something we would have thought of on our own. Now, you'll ask me, why is that? I have no idea. I don't know.
Are we supposed to think that every disease in the Torah society that's working as it should be is a manifestation of a spiritual something?
Correct. Right, but he's saying here the Torah gave it special mention and a special system.
I think it's, you know, what are we supposed to learn from it?
I don't know. Yes. I don't know. Yes?
Based on everything you shared with us, if a woman, let's say, is bleeding for 6 days, and then she
is, and then she's clean, it shouldn't be that she's not a Nida or a Zava, because there was no blood
outside of the normal. Well, no, the second she has her onset, she's a Nida. Right, but a Zava is only if she has it randomly.
If she has it within those 11 days
so
after her.
If it wasn't in those clean days, it was just the regular ones.
She's a Nida.
And she's a Nida, but not
right.
A Zava. So
correct.
We should be able to have sex 3 weeks.
Correct.
3 weeks.
Correct. But the daughters of Israel saw that it was a bad idea. You're 100% right. This was something that was initiated by the women. The women realized that this was not working. You have to realize that a woman's period, most of the time, is not a constant.
Right.
Meaning women fluctuate. They don't. Most women don't know what day it's going to happen. And the women took this upon themselves, and then the rabbis approved. Meaning it started from the ground up. This was a grassroots movement. Then the rabbis instituted it, and today that's halacha. Today, anytime a woman has her onset, biblically she's a nida till she goes to mikveh. And she may not go to mikveh, it won't do anything if she goes to mikveh before the seventh day. Now, to keep account, I'm giving a very simplified version of the halacha. You understand, there's a whole tractate on this. I'm giving the headlines. You can't judge by the headlines. There are a lot of details that complicate the count. Okay, I'm giving you a simple version. You know, a classical woman, a classical month, this is the classical system. It can get much more complicated.
Well, I still understand why after the full week there's a problem. Why can't you just go to the mikveh after the week?
In the days of the first temple, that's what they would do. A woman would have her onset. After 5 or 6 days, it would stop. If she was completely clean, then on the seventh day, she could check herself and go to mikveh. Right? That's the biblical ruling. In Moshe Rabbeinu's time, in the first temple's time, that's what they would do. But let's give another scenario, which is very common today. Okay? The average woman today spots. Meaning the average woman doesn't start her period like Niagara Falls. You know, one second she's clean, the next second, boom, she's having a period. She has a spot today, she has 5 spots tomorrow, and then the period starts. Meaning, the average woman has an involvement. Now, from where do you start your 7 days? Okay, so let's say her first spot was on the first, but her real period started on the third. Now, you can understand that it's easily going to hit the eighth or the ninth. Now, you're going to run into problems, right? Aside from that, most women end with spotting. They don't end. It's not like the valves shut off, everything's clean. There's it starts gradually and it ends gradually. Again, I said most women. There are those exceptions. The Talmud discusses them and science agrees that exists. There are women who 1 second are clean and the next second are gushing, and those women will sometimes end their period in a much shorter time. Meaning a woman can come clean after a day or 2 days or 3 days. Meaning, each side has its benefits. average woman would probably prefer having some warning, meaning it's more comfortable to know that it's evolving. But whatever, you know, we don't have a choice. At any rate, you could see that it can get complicated. We're taking a simplified case. When you start dealing with the spotting before, the spotting after. Imagine on day 11 she had spotting. On day 12 she started her period. Now, do you count 7 clean days? Do you not count? From where do you count? I'll give you another scenario. Let's say on day 10 she had spotting. On day 10 and on day 11. Those are your Yemeziva. Now on day 12 she has her period. Do we view that period as a new period? Or is that a continuation of the Ziva from day 10 and 11? Right? Remember we said you have 11 days in between. So on day 12 or day 19, that's already the time she's expecting her period. So that's Nida. But if it started on day 17 and 18 and ran into 19... So that's Ziva, but that could very easily get confused with Nida, right? She says, no, this is my period already. So we're taking the simple version. Where everything works classically, so yes, it can be a simple system. We haven't discussed situations of childbirth. We haven't discussed other situations. There's a lot to discuss. Okay, we haven't discussed the issue of... Okay, let's leave it now. This wasn't our topic. This was just a tangent. So, fine. So we have a Zav and a Zava. They share the name because they both have a flow, but biologically it's very different. As far as their sacrifice and their impurities, they're very similar. And then we have a tummy mace, even though tummy mace seems to be most severe, but it isn't in this area. A tummy mace, a person became defiled by a corpse, so then he only has to stay out of the holiest camp. And that's why there's a discussion, where may we go on the Temple Mount? Because we're all Tmei Mace. We've all been defiled by dead bodies. We've all come in contact either with a graveyard, or we traveled under a tree that was an overhang over a graveyard and over the street. So everyone's a Tmei Mace. Maybe we've all come into contact with metal objects that were in a graveyard. You know, you shake someone's hand, you brush by their watch. If they were ever in a graveyard, that watch also defiles like a corpse. So we're all tummy mace. Now you want to go up to the Temple Mount. So you got to figure out where may you go, because we have correspondences in halacha. And the other issue we have to be concerned about is that people aren't always careful about what comes out of them when they go to the bathroom. Sometimes a person can have a urinary issue where there's ziva coming out. He's going to the bathroom, but other things are coming out as well. And he might not even notice it. And if you want to go up on the Temple Mount, so a person has to go to mikveh, and there's a special mikveh you have to go to. So there are a lot of details. That's why it's a complex situation. I don't know why people take it so lightly going up. Yes?
Let's say, for example, the temple gets conquered, okay? And now we need to reconquer. So you're a soldier, right? You're reconquering it, right? Are you allowed, basically, do the laws of not going up to the Temple Mount get nullified as by kibush haaretz?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. More than that, if you look in Rav Nevenzal's commentary on the Mishnah Brura, he goes into the leniencies today for a modern day soldier or policeman about where they may travel up there when they're in service. He actually addresses that point. There's another interesting book called Sofayich, if I'm not mistaken. Rav Gershuni also has a piece on that. Okay, back to our parsha. Yes?
You said it's a special mikveh. How is it different from a normal one that you put
in? A regular mikveh is rainwater. That's what's called mikveh. Mikveh means an enclave where you have standing water that's rainwater that was never inside a vessel. Then you have mayim chayim. You have water that's flowing from an underground stream. Zav has to immerse himself in water that comes from an underground stream. The only way a Zav can become tar is if he immerses himself in that water. So one would have to ensure that that water is really from an underground stream. You go to many rivers, so then they are primarily rainwater. It seems like a river, it's flowing. Now rainwater is not kosher when it's flowing. Rainwater is only kosher when it is in a mikveh, standing in an enclave. Even if you had rainwater standing in a mikveh, but you had a stream that turned on one end, and you had a plug that was open on the other end, and water was running, it was all rainwater, but it was all flowing, that mikveh is not kosher. So rainwater is only kosher when it's standing, And stream water can be flowing, but you got to find a real underground stream, water that's coming from an underground stream, and that's what would purify a person if he was a Zav. Again, I'm skipping a lot of details. You asked, so I'm addressing this point specifically. There's more to be discussed about how a person has to cleanse themselves before they go to mikvah. There are a lot of things to discuss. I just want to mention one point. Once we've discussed Nida and Zava, so you should realize that from the minute a woman had her onset, could be she was 12 or 11, or doesn't matter. From the second she had a menstrual bleeding, she is Tameh, finished. Until she will do 7 days of cleanliness and check herself those 7 days and go to mikvah, 15 years, 500 years could pass. It doesn't matter. She's Tameh. That Tumah doesn't leave unless she does the 7 days of cleanliness and goes to mikvah. So sometimes people think, you know, so many years passed, must be okay. No, it has nothing to do with it. That's why we assume that a person has to be careful. Aside from the laws of Negiah, affectionate touching is also prohibited because a woman is assumed to be a Nida. Any woman that's not married, the assumption is she's a Nida. Normal women have had their onset, and that would prohibit affectionate touching. Affectionate, I don't mean like a father and daughter. I mean affectionate like a husband and wife. That even the touching would be prohibited because she's a Nida. Yes, yes.
A few questions. One, so based on what you said about flow of water, the Kinneret technically is not a kosher mikvah because there's rainwater coming in on one side and rainwater leaving out the other. Even though most of
I don't know. If most of it is stream water, so then probably it is okay.
But if, let's say, it's a lake that is rainwater,
then it would not be okay, right?
Water leaving and water coming in.
So that's a famous story. There was a young rabbi came to a town. After a few weeks, he says, "Hey, gentlemen, where's your mikvah?" So they say, "We all live around the lake. We all use the lake." So he sat down and did some research and verified that the lake was all rainwater. And like you said, the lake was flowing. So he said, "I'm very sorry to tell you, you guys have been using a non-kosher mikvah." So they said, "We're very sorry to tell you, we don't buy it." So he's the new rabbi in town. He didn't know what to do. So he said, "Okay, don't take my word for it. We'll go to the chief rabbi of Hungary, the Chassam Sofer." And we have a responsa from the Chassam Sofer where he basically tells them, "I'm very sorry. All your children are sons of Nidas. Your wives are all impure. Your mikvah's not kosher." There's a second response out of this young rabbi, because when they tried setting up the mikveh, he found another deficiency. So he basically tells the Chassam Sofer, "I can't do this again, you know. There's a limit to how much they're going to buy from me." What was happening then was that on Friday night, the women would want to go to mikveh early. You're not supposed to go before sunset. And they were scared because the mikveh was just past the shul. And if they didn't go early, then all the women coming out of mikveh would meet all the men. So they didn't want to do that, right? So they would all go early. So he said, "You know, you're not supposed to go early." But they didn't want to listen to him. "You know, Rabbi, we just built this mikveh because of you. Now you're going to tell us..."
What do you mean, go early?
Meaning a woman is supposed to immerse herself at the mikveh either when the stars come out or some hold at sunset, but not before that. Okay, so at any rate, back to our parasha. Yes?
I have two more questions. There's an opinion...
I'm lost now. Were you in the middle of something?
No.
There's an opinion that says, thank you, Rabbi. There's an opinion that says that going up to the Temple Mount nowadays is part of Kibush Haaretz. And there's an opinion that says that you can go anywhere in the Temple Mount because it's part of reconquering the Temple Mount.
I'm not familiar with that. I'm unaware of such an opinion.
Okay. Now, the second question is, if a girl wants to go up to the Temple Mount, it's basically the same laws, right? She needs to go
no.
to the
mikvah? No. She should consult a local Orthodox rabbi. There are a lot of details I left out for a man also. I just mentioned one aspect of it. I didn't discuss the preparations for mikvah and other things. I mentioned one aspect. I didn't cover it. That wasn't our subject here tonight. Let's get back to the parasha. Okay, we have a concept of a person who steals. We have a mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah says if a person stole and then took a vow and lied, And he says, no, I never took the object from you. So then when he returns the object, so then he has to bring a special sacrifice over swearing falsely. And he also has to add a fifth. Now what happens if the person he stole from died? So you give it to the relatives. What happens if the person has no relatives? So then you give it to the Kohen. So the Talmud right away asks, who is it that doesn't have relatives? Yeah. We'll all trace ourselves back to Avraham Avinu, right? The ger. So then, if the ger was robbed, and the guy lied and took a vow, a false vow, so now the ger dies and he has to pay back, and there's no one to pay back to. So who does he give it to? The Kohanim. Why does he give it to the Kohanim? Because technically we view a ger as a son of God. And so Hashem says, give it to a family member, a member of my house. The Kohen is a member of my house. So if you stole from the ger and you have to pay him back, so you really got to pay me back. Okay, so give it to one of the members of my house. That's why the Kohen gets it. The Kohen gets it. Yes?
How does the Beis Din decide which Kohen to give it to?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's a good question. They give it to a Kohen who was on guard that week when it comes to court. A Kohen Shebotom Mishmar. Now, how they choose which one, I have in mind that they drew lots, but I don't know where I got that from. That's what I have in mind. I think it says that in the Tosefta and Sota, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure where I'm getting that from. I'm not sure it's right. I have to look it up. Yeah?
Previous question. About dead animals. That is tomorrow night.
Which? So we have 8 Shmona Shratzim that defile, and then we have Tumas Nevela Sa'of. That if you eat it, one becomes defiled in the Beis Habliya. We'll get to one thing at a time.
Okay. Here, the Gerim is supposed to have a separate camp. I just read in the commentary. So how does go? They have wife also.
But, I didn't understand again. Ah, but they don't get their wife's section.
Doesn't the wife inherit the husband?
If there are sons, no. The inheritance has to take care of her. Okay. Meaning there's a division. The assets remain to take care of her. But it's not considered that she inherits them. It's considered that there's an obligation to take care of her.
But if the girl is just wife, the wife receives?
Yeah, then she inherits it. Yeah. Well, it's a little, you're asking a practical question or a halachic question. Practically, so there are ways to set up a will. There are halachic ways to set up a will. Practically.
I just read in the commentary that the Gerim has a separate camp in the camp of Israel.
Okay.
So I thought that the Gerim are spread away in the 12 tribes of Israel,
I don't remember. I don't remember. Show me the commentary. I don't remember. I'm sorry. Okay, let's move forward to the story of a sota. First thing you have to know about a sota is don't do it. I'm serious. The first halacha you have to know about a sota is a person should never tell his wife, I don't want you to be alone with so-and-so. Because there is an opinion in halacha that says that you don't need witnesses for the warning. So halachically, once a person warns his wife, I don't want you to be alone with your father, your brother, the next door neighbor, if she was alone and 2 witnesses witnessed it, that's it, she's prohibited on him. He can't continue living with her. Because once a woman went through the motions of becoming a sota, it is biblically prohibited for her husband to rejoin with her until it's verified whether she cheated on him or not. So the Torah says, you want to warn her? You can warn her. The idea here is God says, I want peace between the two of you. The camp of Israel is based on purity, that people are faithful to one another. By the way, the waters don't work if he cheated on her. If he was unfaithful to her, then there's nothing to talk about. None of this will work. It's only if he was 100% and he suspects her of cheating, so then the halacha says, the Torah says, he may tell her, look, I don't want you to be alone with that guy again. And if there are witnesses that she was alone with that guy again, then he takes her to the court, and the court sends them with a mission from the court up to the high temple, and we'll get to that in a second. Yes? perhaps, okay, let's deal with that as we go along, okay? One step at a time. Yes?
Why is it that the Torah is like, okay, when a woman is unfaithful, she basically, her punishment is like death. When a man is unfaithful, I don't even know what's the punishment. Is there a punishment?
Okay. So firstly, you should know that the prophet goes at length to discuss how God is upset at someone who's unfaithful to his wife. You should know that it is addressed. One of the most moving verses we have in the Torah, in the Navi, are about that. Asher hi ishtecha, eshet britcha, ve'eshet neurecha, asher bagadta ba. The Torah does call it a man being unfaithful, and the Torah does hold him to task over it. And there are punishments that are doled out for it. But the Torah does permit a man to marry more than one wife. We have to remember that the system is built differently than what we would maybe think to build it. Why the Torah would build it that way? I don't think in the remaining 10 minutes we can discuss that. It's a long discussion.
It's natural for a man to be able to take care of more than one woman and one woman to want.
But the Jewish home could have trouble with one.
Okay.
What I was saying though is that, like, it just seems, even though a man could marry more than one woman, if he cheats on his wife and someone he's not married to, from a feminist point of view, he should be the same thing. Now, I'm not a feminist, but I want to have something to answer. Without Matashiva, of course, without Matashiva, a feminist, know how to shut up the feminist. So I need to know the answer.
We have 10 minutes left. I just want to see if the rest of the class wants to spend the 10 minutes on that question. I don't know if I'll succeed in 10 minutes, but I can try. How many people want us to focus on that? Okay, so then we'll have to move on. But on Thursday night, Yoshua, you could bring it up again. Thursday night, we have open session. You could ask what you want, and we'll try to deal with it then. Okay, so we have a glaring question Yoshua just raised. We're leaving it on the side for now to be dealt with if you raise it again on Thursday night. But that being as it may, we come back to the system the Torah sets up. God wants peace in the home. In order for there to be peace in the home, there has to be trust. There has to be the most basic trust that people are faithful to one another. And when that trust is breached, so then God says, I'm willing to have my name erased into those waters just to bring peace back into the home. So the story of the sotra is really about ensuring that things are right. The Navi says that lo'efkod al benotechem ki tiznena. I'm not going to do this, God says, if adultery is rampant. The assumption is that 99.99999% of the homes are fine. And then if there's one in 100,000 women, that's not fine. So then God says, okay, I'll get into the picture. Benny pointed out correctly that this woman did something improper. But we have to realize that the Talmud asks, the description of the warning that the husband gives the wife is called v'kinei et ishto. Now the word kin'ah could mean to be zealous in a good way or a bad way. And so the Talmud asks, is the Torah really supportive of this attitude? And the Talmud has different opinions. The Talmud says, you know, sometimes you have a husband who's all antsy. Why'd you tell the neighbor good morning? What's wrong with you? Why are you telling the neighbor good morning? And how come you asked him how a sick baby's doing? So you have people who are very antsy. Then you have people where she goes over to the neighbor and she comes back at 3 o'clock in the morning and he doesn't ask her, hey, you know, he's a bachelor. What were you doing there till 3 o'clock in the morning? That's also not right. We have the famous allegory, Chazal tell us, when you have a cup of wine, right? You guys know the allegory? Okay, Chazal say you have a cup of wine and a fly falls into it. So one guy takes a spoon, takes out the fly and drinks the wine. One guy throws out the whole cup and says, I can't drink this wine. And the next guy, he drinks the wine and then he takes the fly out and sucks the fly to make sure he's got every little drip off of it. So the Talmud says that's the way it is in marriage. You have one guy who says, He locks the door when he leaves the house. He locks all the windows. He wants to make sure nothing wrong happens with his wife. That was Pappus, our sages say. That was Pappus. His wife was the famous Mary. Didn't work, right? That's why he ended up having we know who. But he tried. He'd lock her in the house. He locked every door. He locked every window. And still she cheated on him. And so Yeshu came to the world. Then you have a guy who's the exact opposite. He sees his wife joking around with guys, spending time at night with guys, and he doesn't care. So that's also wrong. That's like the guy who sucks the fly after he's drank the wine. Then you have a normal guy, the Gemara says, what's normal? You know your wife's going to be nice to the neighbors, you know that she's going to be polite to the neighbors, and you know that she's going to talk to her siblings, and she's going to talk to her parents, and that's normal, and that's part of normal life. So that's the Talmud says there's a balance, and the same thing with the story of Sota. You have the people who are going to use it improperly. You have the people who he's going to tell her, look, I don't want you talking to so-and-so. And she says, you brute, why do you always suspect me? What's wrong with you? Why is it that anything I do, you have something to say? And then there's fighting all over the house. The Gemara says that, yeah, that's what's going to happen. He's going to tell her, I don't want you, you're too friendly with so-and-so. And then there's going to be a fight that erupts. The Talmud says, wait a second, who's right? The Talmud says, sometimes him and sometimes her. Sometimes it's because he's so right that he makes the comment. And sometimes it's that he's so wrong. And that's why the Talmud has differing opinions as to whether it's a recommended thing to do to make this warning. So that was true when you had a temple and you had the Sota waters. Today we don't have that. The Rambam says there are two mitzvos in the Torah that are miraculous. All mitzvos work within nature but two. The mitzvah of tzaras, there's no natural explanation as to why a person would get this disease just because he said Lashon Hara. In the midst of Sota, there's no natural explanation. Now the Gemara also gives us a warning. The Gemara says, if he's cheating on his wife, what the Gemara says, Ihu bei butzine itite bei kare. If you're going to pick large onions, your wife's going to pick small onions. In other words, if he's going to cheat on her, he can be confident she's going to find a way to cheat on him. It goes both ways. The Gemara says, you know, in the beginning of Sota, people think, you know, what's wrong? Why did this happen to me? So the Gemara says, yeah, sometimes it happens. Sometimes a guy lands with an evil wife. But sometimes it's also because he was wrong and it doesn't work. The Sota waters don't work if he was not faithful. The Sota waters don't work if after she was caught the second time, he still slept with her. That's why the court sends a mission with him to ensure that he can remain faithful to his anger, because in fact, once she's been warned and she went again and was alone with the guy, and you have witnesses that that's what happened, and no one knows what happened behind closed doors, no one knows what happened in that room, so then already we have to verify. Now, when they bring her up to the temple, we plead with her, we tell her, look, if you did something wrong, why should you die? People do foolish things. Sometimes neighbors can arouse people to do things that are wrong. Did you hear that again? Sometimes neighbors can arouse people to do things that are wrong. Harbe yaldutosa. Many things happen because a person's childish, because a person is lightheaded. Harbe shchenim ra'im osim. Bad neighbors can bring on a lot of bad things. These are warnings the Gemara is giving us. But you know what? This was part of a standard speech that they would give her as they bring her up to the temple. The priest would take her aside and say, lady, it's a pity you should die. If you were unfaithful, so admit to it, and you two will get divorced and you'll start a new life, but why should you die over here? And then they'd take her up to the temple and they'd interview her and she'd say, no, I did nothing wrong, nothing happened in that room. And they'd say, look, it's up to you, but you should know that very pious people messed up in life. If you look back at Reuven, look, Reuven did something wrong. He went and admitted it. He still remained one of the tribes. You could still rectify life. Look at what happened with Yehuda. Yehuda went with Tamar. He admitted what he did wrong. Fine people can make mistakes. Better admit. Why should we erase God's name for nothing and you should die? No. Admit it if you did it wrong. And if she's still adamant, we take her all the way down the Temple Mount again. We interview her a second time. We take her back up the Temple Mount. Now she's getting tired from this up and down. We're trying to wear her down psychologically. We don't want her to die unnecessarily. What we do want is a verification. If she's adamant, no, I'm innocent, I'm clean, I'm innocent, I'm clean. Okay, fine. If you're innocent, fine. So then we have the Sota procession, where they would draw lots, which Kohen would do the procession, and whichever Kohen was drawn would have to do it, even if it was the high priest, even if it was the Kohen Gadol. And then they'd come in, and after the interview, they'd bring the sacrifice, which was made of oats. Ordinarily, sacrifices are made of flour, wheat flour. This is made of seorim, barley. I'm sorry, not oats. Seorim, barley, animal food. We're saying, you know, what we're talking about is behaving like an animal. We don't pour oil. This is a sacrifice of a sin offering. We don't put lavona. We don't put spices on it. The idea here is this is to ensure there was no sin here. There's nothing nice about this. And then we take waters from the holy waters of the Kiyor, and we take some of the earth from the Mishkan, or the earth that was in the temple. We put it in the waters, and the Kohen has her hair uncovered. This is the source that a Jewish woman should cover her hair. Because this woman, part of the procession is, it's described that her hair is uncovered. And then he gives her the mincha offering. And we bring the waters, and then he writes the whole parsha of Sota, the whole parsha in our parsha. He writes, this is the warning. This is what happens to a woman who does it. And this is the curse, that if a woman was unfaithful, so then everyone should testify, you know, this is a curse that came true. And then the woman has to accept it. This is where we have the words amin in the Torah. She says, I accept the curse if I was wrong. And then he starts erasing the whole parsha he wrote, including God's name, into the water. And she's going to drink those waters. She wouldn't finish the cup before her eyes would start bulging and her cheeks would bulge and she would actually explode. They would try to rush her out of the temple to ensure she wouldn't explode in the temple. But that was if she sinned. Now a miraculous thing happened. If she was really unfaithful, she would die an unnatural death, as would the adulterer. They'd both die. This is something we have no explanation for. But this is our tradition. Our tradition is also that it stopped working once there were so many adulterers. So, and this only works, as we said earlier, if he was faithful to the halacha as well. If we have a witness that was in the room and says she sinned, so we don't do all this. If someone saw what actually happened, so we don't do all this. That's it, they have to get divorced. Gemarnu. Now, I just want to end with one more point. Two things you should know. If a person warns his wife and says, don't be alone with so-and-so, he can take it back. There is such a thing as being matir, to undo the warning. So it's not like once he warned her, that's it for life, she can't be alone in the room with her father. That's number one. Number two, I don't remember what was number two. Yeah, Benny.
One witness or two?
Even one. Okay. Yes.
So women actually, there's recordings of them dying from this. It's not just a way to,
right,
to try to bring peace, like a kind of...
Correct. We have recordings of women who died. We have famous stories about it. Okay, I'll tell you the famous story your kid will come home from Gan with. There were twin sisters. One of them cheated on her husband. He asked her, please don't be alone with the adulterer. And she did it again. And then he said to her, okay, you know, there are witnesses that you were alone with him. We're doing the sota. They went to the court. The court sent them up with a mission. On the way, she said, can I go just stop by my sister and kiss her? She went into her sister and said, look, I'm going to die. Let's switch. And her sister was her identical twin. She switched. And so the husband is going up with a woman that's not his wife. And they warn her and they ask her, did you cheat and did you da-da-da-da? And she says, no, I'm faithful, I'm 100%, I never did anything wrong. And they give her the sota waters and she's fine. And the husband is so happy. Wow. And on the way back, she says, let's just visit my sister. She really means to switch back, right, with her twin. And when they meet, they kiss. And in ancient times, a kiss that meant something was a kiss mouth to mouth. When they kiss, some of the waters entered the twin, who was really the adulterer, and she exploded. That's one of the stories we have on tradition that happened, that even that made her die. So yeah, we have on tradition that it did happen. And it wasn't just like a story. It did happen in Jewish history.